This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/iFanboy.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
You're listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Tom King. Hey, it's Josh Flanagan with iFanboy.com. Thanks to the patrons. It's a Talksplode episode, which is our creator interview podcast. This week, month, day, whichever it is, I spoke with Tom King about his maxi series, Strange Adventures, Rorschach, and even a little bit of the Supergirl book. And other career stuff. You know what? This is a conversation between a couple of people who forget sometimes that they're doing a comic book podcast. That's what I think is happening here. But I had a heck of a good time, and I hope you do too.
So the last time we were on here was June of 2019. And
what the hell was June of 2019? That does not ring a bell.
So when I look it on the calendar, I think, well, that
time before.
I thought that wasn't that long ago. And then I think of everything that's happened between now and then. And it's been a really, I think that's about 40 years since then.
Reality has utterly changed since this is the second time we've had this in our lifetimes, right? Like 9/11 was
yes.
Like this.
Yeah, no, I think that way a lot. And I often frequently think that like, oh, the moment that I became an adult was basically 9/11. And then at the end of sort of that early part of my adulthood was a pandemic. And I was like, I think we kind of got a raw deal.
You and I are about the exact same age.
Yeah,
I think you like a few months on me, or I have a few months on you. Yeah, I divide my life into pre 9/11 because I met my wife just around that exact time too. So yeah, there was like the pre 9/11 me that went to college and high school and was that idiot, and then the post 9/11 me was the semi adult. Now it'll be, I guess now our old age begins with the pandemic. I don't know what fucking
middle
age. That is.
We're middle age now.
But
who knows what's gonna come next?
Well, Porsche, that's what comes next, right? That's what my parents always taught me.
They're from LA.
I remember my divorced father getting the ponytail and the sports car.
Wow.
And I was like, what is this cliche driving up to my house to pick me up?
You didn't think so you're a kid and you didn't think, wow, that car is cool. You realized that he was a divorced cliche. And then you became a writer.
Yes, I was born an old man. I somehow already knew. I don't know. Maybe I was watching up Johnny Carson jokes or something. I don't know what the hell it was. But yeah, we would do stuff. he was looking for his soul and all that in Los Angeles in the early 90s, late 80s. Oh. So like we would go to, various cults from cult to cult. and he would take us. And sometimes it would be sort of a Buddhist based cult, and sometimes like a, like that Nexium kind of based cult. And we would just go as he sort of tried to find like the thing that worked for him to advance his whatever spirituality.
So have you ever been to an ashram? I don't know what an ashram is, but that sounds like the kind of thing that goes along with what you were talking about.
No, my most distinct memory was something where, you got a, you sat in front of a this is all white people. You sat in front of a Buddhist idol.
Well off white people.
Yeah. This was, well off white. They're very like, there's like science, like people who either left Scientology or about to go there, like right. That sort of middle ground. And you repeated the same phrase over and over again. And the more time you repeated the phrase, the luckier life was supposed to be.
Wow.
And I remember, and then people would sort of get up there and testify and be like, I had an audition and I got the part because I said it 40,000 times. And be, yeah.
And you're about how old here?
8, 9, something like that.
Okay, you have kids. Can you imagine for one second your children, certainly not mine, sitting through any of that bullshit?
My kids attend a nice Quaker school. We're not a religious family, but it was just a school where I thought they could make friends.
Sure.
And they teach, nice stuff about peace and understanding and stuff, and it's diverse. But because it's a Quaker school, once a week they have to sit for half an hour in silence and mm-hmm. just stare at the wall. And it drives my children insane.
That's got to be all of them.
Yeah, they just can't. And we go through like, oh, what are we going to think? I was like, make a comic book in your mind. Just like they're just supposed to sit there and let God fill their heads. And I just, my children. Yeah, no, it would be impossible. I cannot accept this family sitting in a chair for 5 hours watching people pray to. That's why I can't stand incense to this day.
It's just an awful smell.
It just flashbacks to that.
Did you the phrase, the like, no more talking, no more fun? Something Quaker has begun? That's what I remember. Maybe that's just maybe that's an anti-Quaker thing somebody said and I learned it and now I don't think you can offend Quakers.
What they do is, it's supposed to be you sit there and sort of the voice of God speaks through you and you stand up. It's a nice way to worship. But what happens with a bunch of kids is the voice of God will speak through one of them and they'll be like, I hope you have a nice day. And then every other single kid hears that same voice of God. Because kids just repeat the next thing that came before them. So it'll go around and around in a circle where like 50 kids will branch up and say, I hope you have a nice day. And then eventually the teachers will stop them and be like, no, that's not what God is saying. Just be quiet.
angry Quaker teachers.
Which I'm sure is hilarious in person, but on a Zoom call it takes another level of absurdity for the year we were doing that.
I hadn't even put that together. This has been the most unique start to one of these comic book interviews I've ever done. And I'm here for it. This is not a complaint.
I try. That's what I'm going for.
So, how has comic book life changed for you during this pandemic?
Cons went away. That was probably the big thing. Like I don't see my friends or I do 5 to 10 to, on my height, I was probably doing 13.
That's a lot.
Once or twice a month almost during the con season between whatever. So that totally went away. But the way it really affected me was it was the thing I clung to it for my own sanity in terms of productivity. Mm-hmm. Just because every week was the same. I mean, we all remember this. It all was for the rest of our lives. And so just psychologically, it always felt good to me to end the week by turning in something. Mm-hmm. To be like, okay, maybe nothing changed in the whole week, but I wrote a script. And because of that, I became incredibly productive. And because DC also paused their comics for 5 months, I just got super far ahead in everything. And it changed the way I write comics. The way I write comics now is complete series because I'm the guy who used to be on Batman, which was double ship where we'd have to write issue 2 and then issue 7 and then issue 22 and then issue 54 and then issue 1. Now I just write 1 through 12 while my series is a novel because of COVID, because I got so far ahead. So it became very productive to me.
Was there a moment in the beginning, like you probably had things in place that you were working on, but was there concern? I mean, there must have been in sort of like where things were going to go, or did you have a pretty good idea about what the plan was, you know, sort of they were going to ramp down and then come back up?
It was so I talked to Jim Lee in the very beginning, and Jim's an incredibly intelligent guy, you know, and probably the smartest guy I've ever met in comics. And he was, you know, he was very logical about it, but we were talking, he's like, and we were both saying, like, the good thing about comics is it doesn't require socialization. Like, we're not like movies and TV. Mm-hmm. Even novels don't really require it, but there's like book tours and stuff. Like, it just takes four people. You know, you need a letterer, you need a colorist, you need a writer, you need an artist. They don't have to be anywhere near each other and you can produce a comic. The only like social interaction is literally like dudes taking comics off a truck and giving it to other people. And so we're like, as long as that those people are okay, it's fine. And then like 2 weeks later was those people fell apart, right? Yeah. Like Diamond's like, oh, our truck drivers can't deliver. And Jim, to his great credit, I think he was genuinely lying through his teeth. I haven't heard this directly from him, but I've heard it from people who know him. He called us and he was like, nope, this is such an opportunity. Just get ahead. Keep going. You know, Marvel shut a lot of people down. DC was like, just keep going, keep writing, keep drawing, get as much on the books as we can, and use this as an opportunity. I'm not sure. I totally believed him at the time, and that's probably one of the other reasons I got productive. At the very beginning of the pandemic, I was like, well, I'm vouchered for this many issues. I better keep turning them in before TZ Comics goes under completely. And but because it, I mean, Jim was totally right. That actually turned out to be good. And it soon became apparent, not immediately, but it soon became apparent that we were all stuck at home and we were all addicted to Amazon, and book sales started to skyrocket. And that sort of carried us through this, through the whole pandemic in terms of sales, and not almost all of us not being fired, was that people just started buying books to read at home.
Do you think that you, you know, in terms of coming up with stuff that you're going to work on, you know, you're not out in the world anymore in the same way, and you're not seeing as much stuff, and so the sort of scope of, I don't want to say influence, but just sort of the input that you get coming in all the time changes. Did you notice that, or did you have, you know, did it feel like you were as productive as ever in that way, or did it change? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, no, and it's such a good question. I think, I mean, comics are, probably be a writer, any medium, it's like a two-step process. There are two things you constantly need in front of you. Mm-hmm. Number one is just the skill to do it. Like, you just have to know like the blue-collar parts of the job, like where to put a comma, where to put a panel break, all the sort of stuff you can be taught. And like the other half is like the inspiration. You have to be like obsessed with something, you know? Mm-hmm. And you can have one or the other, and if you have one without the other, it doesn't work. And vice versa. And like, what you're talking about is like, if you're stuck at home doing nothing, where's your goddamn inspiration? What are you going to become obsessed with? And you just become obsessed with pop culture. So then you're just a pop culture person commenting on pop culture, which just fucking is mental masturbation. So,
and there's a lot of it out there.
Yes. And that was a problem in the pandemic. It's a problem for any writer, cause we don't leave our houses that much as it is. So yeah, I just had to make sure I got obsessed with sort of the right stuff and made sure to sort of mine that. And there was an added problem to that, which, and 9/11 had similar to this, but not as much, I think, but like, I have no desire to ever write anything about the pandemic. I have no desire to watch anything about the pandemic. Do you watch Billions? Do you watch that show Billions?
No, but I know exactly what you're talking about, but go on. I also have an example, I believe.
Yeah, they did a recent where they tried to sort of incorporate, they're like, okay, we take place in the real world, in the real world a pandemic happened. So halfway through the season they took off, and when they came back, like, there was a pandemic and everyone's wearing masks now. And I was just watching the show and I was like, I don't want to see any of it. It took me right out.
It's a massive mistake. Like, you don't need to reflect that part of our world, because we all live in that world already. And you have nothing to say about it because you're in the middle of it and you have no perspective. I have very strong feelings on it. We were watching, there's the morning show on Apple TV, and they come back for the second season, and they're like, it's at the beginning part, it's like December, and they're like, well, we're starting to see reports out of China. It's like, I don't do this story. Yeah. Don't need you to do this story at all.
Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah, I feel the same. I mean, it's, and we're not alone in this. Like, I have a history. My college roommate is a professor of history at the University of Richmond, a American history professor. And I was like, at the very beginning of this, we talked about the plague of, you know, 1918. And he's like, the amazing thing about that plague is there's so much literature about the war that took place at the same time, but there's almost nothing about that plague. Like, people just didn't want it. They didn't write books about it. They didn't write plays about it. It kind of appears here and there on the edge of things, but it's just never entered popular culture. And we're being like, oh, that's weird. Now I totally understand. I was like, I just don't want to fucking talk about it. I have no desire to reflect this in any way.
Well, what's interesting, though, too, is that, you know, I know history fairly well. And that is a thing that kind of snuck up on me at one point because it kind of doesn't exist. And it's this huge end bookmark to World War One. But it's not even part of the story most of the time. Now, at the same time that I don't really feel like watching anything about the pandemic now, you know, other than like news I need to know. I've watched a couple of documentaries and read some books and stuff about the pandemic then. That is fascinating.
That's true. Yeah, it's nice to look back on it. I don't want to look towards my own life.
I guess I don't know if it's nice, but the constant is you're like, oh, this is exactly the same. We've learned nothing. Everybody's acting the exact same way they did then, you know, and they just got lucky it went away. Like, it's very scary.
So, anyway. Yeah, I mean, that's problematic. As far as I know, we also have that stupid Twitter feed about when the last time your kids had a normal school year, where it's like my kid, I have a 7-year-old and he's kindergarten, first grade. He's now in second grade. He's never had a normal school year. And that should be reflected in our culture, but I have no desire to put that in a comic at all. I have no desire to put DC Comics through this to have scenes of people. Artists would probably love it. Not to draw half a face, but
I think that comics are like the mainstream comics are the last place that needs to be.
Right.
I mean, not for nothing is that also, you know, if you look at the audience, the people who are reading comics right now, like they know they're living it. It's fine. Like, I don't feel like we're in a point where we need art to make conclusions about it for us that we didn't realize. We're not there. Like, we just don't understand it yet. But no, that's terrible. No, that shouldn't be.
See, yeah, you have to talk about it through. I mean, that's what makes superhero comics good. It's like you can talk about this shit through metaphors and through like. That's why you read Jim Starlin's shit or his Warlock stuff, which is all about drugs in Vietnam. But drugs in Vietnam aren't mentioned at all in it. Mm-hmm. It's just that was just like on his mind and in his heart when he wrote about going cosmic. That's what came out. That's what it has to be.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that the thing about the kids where you say, oh, the kid hasn't had a normal year of school because of this or that or whatever. And what I thought is, well, yeah, but these are actual formative experiences, you know, like, and we talk about like our grandparents who grew up during the Depression or whatever, and how that sucked at the time, but afterwards it stuck with them. And in some ways that were beneficial, in some ways that weren't or whatever. And what I thought was a lot of times like, well, good. My kids have to go through something difficult. Like, they shouldn't.
I like that positivity. All right.
It's kind of true. Like, nothing is difficult for them. Like, we live in the easiest time it's ever been to live, you know, if you're a middle-class kid in America. Like, it's not hard for them. And there's challenges and there's problems and there's depression and there's all sorts of things like that. But, like, really existential dread, you know, like, you know, again, we really, our age is just perfect. Like, to grow up with nuclear existential dread as a child, think you got past it, 9/11 happens, think you got past that. It's like just bing, bing, bing. We didn't get wars in the same way, but we got, you know.
I remember some wars. I feel like I saw some.
Maybe, yeah, but it wasn't like World War II, where like every single person, and World War I, where every single person knew people who went and did the whole thing, and the entire society got behind it. And I know who I'm saying this to, but for most people, they didn't have to deal with it if they didn't want to. You know, like, there was not an us. You know,
I mean, every generation can complain, but like, yeah, I feel like we hit high school just when Columbine happened, so things weren't fun anymore. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we graduate from college just as the tech boom burst. and then we're like, okay, things are going to get better now. And 9/11 happens and we have kids and the pandemic happens. Like, what the fuck?
You know, it's not the Irish potato famine.
Good point. Good point. It's not the Irish potato family.
I really like it. And especially as through this whole thing, you know, I the whole time I kept going, I feel pretty lucky. Like, it sucks, but, you know, I already work from home. I'm already, you know, like, I don't really need to go see a bunch of people. I'm fine with it. It's just, this has nothing to do with comics, but here we are. I'm sorry. You know, that was my perspective, though, like, the whole thing. Like, there were times where I'd be a real bummer, but I just thought, Jesus, I'm like I'm so lucky. And I really thought that. And I'm not a positive person. So that's that. But it was so clear, like, you know, I'm not having to drive a truck and go into places and do things and work and, you know, but my kids, that's the part where they felt it. My younger kid, like, he wanted to be in school. My older kid didn't give a shit. He's like, this is the best year ever. My the first one was like.
Same with mine. Yeah, my older and younger. Exact same. Yeah, I totally agree with it. But every once in a while, like, my kid lost his tooth recently, his two front teeth. So he's got one of those classic 7-year-old no teeth smiles. And I was like, and he was so excited about it. You'd think he'd turn into a superhero. He was like, I changed. And I was like, are you going to show your friends at school? He's like, oh, I can't because I wear a mask. So I was like, oh, that's, what a depressing little thought.
Wow, yeah, you're not wrong. Well, so anyway, I think this stuff will probably work its way into your work is what I'm getting at.
But not directly. I will not be talking about this.
No.
There won't be no contagions in my work. I'll tell you them.
That does bring me to something I was thinking about. I think that what I'm going to do is I want to talk about Strange Adventures, and then I want to talk about Rorschach and whatever. And I feel like some of my discussion points will be the same thing, but I don't want to do them concurrently. So here we go. Strange Adventures just wrapped up. Just before we got on here, I reread or at least thoroughly combed through the last 5 or 6 of them so I could get an idea of sort of where it was going from the other side. And I mean, I guess my main thought about it was, where did you start? Like, what was the germ of that? And you know, how did that compare to where you ended up? Because, you know, reading it in issues a month apart or whatever it is, I think there's a lot of room for things to be missed because there's a lot of details, there's a lot of things going on around, and you've got to build this. And so where do you start? Like where, what was your first thought about this? Where does this come from?
I mean, it's funny we start with the pandemic because both those books are sort of pre-pandemic books in my head. They were both written, they're very much, I don't want to get political at all because that's a boring waste of a podcast, but they're very much Trump books. They're very much like when the world seemed very insane in 2019, even before the pandemic.
Well, it's interesting because as the pandemic starts, comics get hit with this wave of the world is fucked comics.
Yes.
And obviously they had started before that, but like there was something in the zeitgeist in the water, you know, all different forms of it, but all comics were like apocalypse, you know, like a third of Image's output was apocalypse at the time the pandemic was starting. And I was like, this is not okay. Anyway, go ahead.
I had written these books, Mr. Miracle, Heroes, and Batman, which were basically the sort of along this theme of like, sometimes you get hurt. Sometimes you get hurt real bad. But if you find love and comfort, you can sort of get through these bad moments. Mm-hmm. And then like, there was like a genuine niceness to those books. And then after like, that was like a 2016-17 thing. So when I, 18-19, I was, the niceness would turn into quite a bit of anger, you know, like, I was ready to write some angry books, some books that were about like corruption and evil. And so that's where I sort of started with the book. And I mean, it started
and
from a place.
You thought of it in terms of you were thinking about those concepts and then you were trying to figure out a thing to push it into.
Yeah. Sort of those sort of bigger themes. I mean, this book started, I had the basic pitch for it before Mr. Miracle ended. So we're talking 2017 or something, or 2018 around then.
I have no concept of time. So whatever you say, I'm going to do.
Me neither. That's what I vaguely remember. It was early enough that the Mueller investigation still seemed like something legitimate, like that it was going to be amazing.
Like there would be consequences for stuff that happened?
Like a lot of us, especially of us of the narrative inclination, were like, whoa, Robert Mueller's a fucking Vietnam vet, Republican, soft. He was like the anti-Trump, right? Mm-hmm. He was like, Trump was just spilling all his stuff out. And Robin was like, I'm just going quietly along, gathering evidence. And we're like, oh, it's coming. It's coming. Like the hero, you know, the Gary Cooper's riding into town. It's going to be high noon. Like that. There was still that spirit in the air, which seems so ridiculous now.
We hadn't quite had it whipped out of us.
No, so I think that was in the back of my head. Someone had sent me, this is so absurd, but someone had sent me a mean tweet right around the time I was thinking of this, because I had to come up with the idea. I was at Mitch's place. I was there for kids' baptism in Arizona. And we were sort of going through shelving, like, what should we do next? And he's like, how about Adam Strange? And I was like, oh, okay. And so I went to my hotel that night. And I was just bored out of my mind. So I just tried to think of this idea. And I think that night, someone had sent me a tweet being like, Tom King is a war criminal who writes comics to hide that fact. Like, it was something like that. I was like, that is not true at all. But it's kind of a cool story. You know, it's like.
Thank you, sir. It was definitely a sir.
Yeah, so I was like, thank you, sir. I appreciate your anime emoji. And so I was that tweet and then the Mueller Trump thing. I was like, what if this was like the idea of a guy being investigated by someone else, and it was a cat and mouse game with sort of a two people going directly at it, a la Mueller Trump. And one person was hiding their war crimes behind a facade of telling brilliant stories. And the other one was actually a good person. And so that was the general sort of kernel of what the idea became. And as I was sitting there, I was like, okay, Adam Strange can be the war crime guy because he has this sort of weird past where he lived on another planet and came here and he'd been in this big war. And I was like, I needed a good character. I'd done so many fucking sad white guys. I was like, I don't want to do a sad white guy again. And I had just watched, as dumb as it is, Mr. Terrific on the Justice League, not Unlimited, Justice League Action, which was an underrated little show on Cartoon Network. Yeah. And I loved the Mr. Terrific episode. And I was like, how about Mr. Terrific is Mueller, Adam Strange is Trump, and we'll go from there. And also Mitch was having, I just put Mitch through the fucking ringer in terms of these 9-panel grids for 12 issues. And I was like, if we could divide the art so that we could like tell two different stories at once, that would help Mitch. And Mitch and Doc are best friends. I was like, how about if Doc tells the story? And I literally pitched it to Mitch over while we drove to get Starbucks the next day. And that was the beginning of it. Evolved from there, but that's the beginning.
Did it take much of a leap for you to be like, I guess I'll make Adam Strange the bad guy? And do you consider him the bad guy? I know, like, you know, he had to make tough choices and everything. But in the end, he's the bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, if my comics have one theme, and it's probably the exact wrong theme for this era, so I apologize, but it's, again, the theme of our generation, maybe not the generation of our, is that not all evil is completely evil, sure. Not all good is completely good. Like my comics are about grace. So, are we doing total spoilers for everything in this? Is this like an after?
Let's say that, yeah. It's after the fact. If you haven't read it, you should go back and read it. But I don't think there's any point in having this conversation if we don't talk about it. So,
all right. So yeah,
there's no point in talking to you unless. Go ahead, sorry.
But I mean, Adam Strange is sort of an evil reflection of Scott Free, and I like the idea from the beginning of like everyone was being like, oh, Tom writes about the same guy over and over again. It's this guy who goes through war and then he gets sad and then his wife helps him, and I was like, Adam Strange will be that, but instead of making the right choice, he'll make the wrong choice. Mm-hmm. Like, instead of being the... Because good guys are formed that way, sure, but bad guys are also formed that way. And so everyone's going to think I'm just creating another Scott Free, and the twist will be that I'm actually creating something darker. I wouldn't say Adam... I mean, he's not... The choice he makes sense to me in terms of being, you can be a good person and make the choice he makes, which is he's sitting there, he's been tortured, he's been drugged, and he's facing this enemy, and the enemy's like, I'm going to kill your daughter, I'm going to kill your wife, I'm going to kill your adopted planet unless you agree to do this. And he's like, my job is to save those, to save my daughter, my wife, and my planet. And I agree. And I think he's not evil, but he's,
yeah,
but he's a little dumb. He's not as smart as Scott.
I think that's true. And at the end, you look at his choice and you can say, well, I did the math or whatever, but I think it gets very difficult to justify giving up your kid, which, I mean, like as a parent or which, you know, like it makes sense in all sorts of ways, but at the end of the day, no one can forgive that, I think.
Yes. Yes.
And then, and also giving up the earth. I mean, those are the two. Yeah. But you, even then, did you see where my mind went? I don't remember the earth thing. I remember the kid thing.
That's right. That's what his wife remembers too. So that was fair. Alana's point. And telling your wife to lie. But in his head, he was just like, okay, this is the only way to get this deal. I give up my kid for a year and I get her back and I get my planet back and I get my wife back.
I think that was the part as I went through them and it stuck with me. What you're saying makes sense, but the bits and this didn't make sense as I was reading it through the first time because I did not know. It was, you know, he's with his wife and acting like everything is okay. And I think that's where he falls apart for me, because that's not fair to her. Like he's like, well, we get to be together. It's good, right? And maybe he's lying to himself or whatever, you know, but I mean, I'd shoot him too.
I think he knows Adam's. Someone asked, but someone just asked God for, like, Adam is not. I mean, he's a so to get back to the origin stories of this whole, which were the sort of, I was like, okay, I'm gonna write about Adam Strange. I'm gonna do some research on sort of what the fucking Adam Strange is, and so I read, you know, you start with the original, so I read the Carmine Infantino stuff, and I was like, where does all this crap come from? So then I started reading sort of all these general narratives that were copied from this, you know, basically Buck Rogers, what's his name, John Carter from Mars, and Tarzan, and like there, and all of that shit. I was like, oh, all of this is just cut. I mean, is this all just D.H. Lawrence's shit? It's the D.H. Lawrence story over and over again, where it's like white guy who's a failure in England, you know, literally a bass, you know, as they used to call them, second sons, goes over to a foreign land that's full of brown people, leads them to a revolution, marries the princess, becomes an incredible person. And that's the Adam Strange story. It's a literal photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of D.H. Lawrence. And by the way, that's the story of Dune, which is out in theaters right now. That's one of the books I read as research for this. Dune is almost the ultimate distillation of that story. So my feeling on that was always like these men in actual real life are not as impressive as they make them out, that they make themselves out to be. They're people who couldn't succeed in one place, so they succeeded in another where they had the advantages of colonialism on their side. And so that was how I always thought of Adam, as sort of, he's a guy who was kind of a not that great architect who kind of fell into something and got beamed to another planet where he sort of had his advantages. So I projected that onto him, where he's just not quite as competent and as good as someone like Scott Free.
What is your thinking around the idea that, you know, that goes against, and this works for you narratively, but it goes against the idea of the superhero. So, you know, you hear Strange Adventures, you see the guy, he's got the fin. Oh, he's a superhero. This is a superhero comic book. He's going to be that. And it isn't. So you're constantly playing against that idea through the whole thing, you know, where, you know, it's difficult not to see him as a hero because we are so trained over, you know, decades of reading superhero comics that it there's a cognitive dissonance that goes on through it. So, were you aware of that part and playing with it? Because I kept trying to, as I read back through it, and I hope you design these to be reread, because I don't know that you can get it the first time. But that puts a lot of onus on, not onus, but faith in your reader, I guess. You know, like, did you, I guess you knew who he was right from the beginning, but you're playing against what we're thinking as we're reading it.
Yeah, I mean, there was one website that kept giving reviews like, why does Tom endorse all these things that Adam's doing? He's becoming a criminal. And every time an issue would come out, you know, Mitch, I don't read that stuff, but Mitch would read it, and he would just be like, should we just call him and tell him we're not on Adam's side? Should we send him an email or something? To be like, Adam's not the hero of this story. I mean, I've played with that third rail before, and I've gotten burnt by it before. I mean, I got burnt bad with Wally West. trying to sort of fit him into a category of not being a always clean and always good. But
when you say you got burnt by it, though, does it a lot just that a lot of people didn't like it, or?
I mean, if I look back at Heroes in Crisis, I think it got overshadowed by the fact that people did not want Wally West to be in that position, so that people didn't look at what the. Have you heard me talk about Robert Redford in this context before? William Goldman has the famous book On Screenwriting that everybody hears.
Yeah.
That's right, right. And in his book, he talks about the movie. I can't remember what it was, but it's a movie about a stunt plane guy. And it stars Robert Redford. They made it into a movie. You can rent it, I'm sure. And he loved the movie because it was about this stunt plane guy who, like, in his whatever 50th mission is on a stunt plane, and a girl falls on the wing, and he goes on the wing to get her, and his hand slips, and the girl falls over. And it's about sort of the stuntman sort of dealing with his life after that, after fucking up and watching a girl fall off his plane. And Goldman says he goes into the movie theater for the first time and watches it. And as he's watching it, he realizes he's made a huge mistake, and the audience is just hating this movie. And he's like, the big mistake was they just could not accept that Robert Redford, this golden boy, would not save that girl on the plane. I could have put Robert De Niro in there. I could have put Al Pacino in there. But Robert Redford is not going to be on a plane holding someone's hand and let go. And once they saw that, they just weren't buying the movie. And I was like, finally I understand what went wrong with Heroes in Crisis. I was like, I was like, once I had put Wally West as the guy who made a mistake, who tried to make up for it, who kind of the people just weren't. He was the symbol of hope and rebirth. And even though I was like, this is totally logical. He lost his kids. He went crazy. Nope. This is Wally West. He's not going to do it. I was like, oh yeah, I made the Robert Redford mistake. I cast
that's really
wrong.
Interesting. I think that's definitely there. I mean, I think if I look at that story, I think there's an emotional component to the characters that we can't get past sometimes, which makes Adam Strange a pretty good choice because he's pretty innocuous. Like, I like the fin, but that's not really, like, I like the idea of the symbol of the, I like the design, you know, and what it represents in terms of time, but I don't know anything about the dude.
Yeah, he'd never, if you go back and actually read his stuff, he hadn't really had any great series. Even the original's not that great. It's very people love Gardner Fox. He did so many good things for the comic industry, but just as a issue to issue writer, his stories were super repetitive. They were very much sort of suck up to Julie Schwartz stories, which Julie Schwartz has sort of a format that he wrote in where you can like introduce a problem, introduce a sort of science method to solve the problem. Everyone's happy. Everyone is generic 1950s guy with a smile,
right?
Blonde hair, blue eye. And those stories are, I mean, they're beautifully drawn. I mean, it's Carmine Infantino and Murphy Anderson. Like you can't have better drawn stories than that, but they're boring. And then, you know, he's kind of floated in and out and never really had anything great. They tried to sort of Watchmen him. They tried to give him a dark sort of series in the late 80s with Andy Kubert art, which is brilliant. The art could not. Yeah. It's Andy inked by his brother, inked by Adam. And it's just, if you ever find that series, just flip through it for the art. But the actual series itself is a little, it's done by like the art director at the time. And it's not that great. No offense to it, but the art is so beautiful. And then, you know, he became Canadian. Jeff Lemire made him Canadian in the aughts for a while. I remember that.
I remember after 52, he and, was it Booster Gold were in a series together? He was okay at that point, but I think it's more like a character like I want to like because I don't really have any reason to.
Yeah, it was him and Animal Man and Starfire
Animal
had like
Man,
a fun
not
series.
Booster Gold. Yeah, that was it.
Which I probably read the way I read comics back then, which was to listen to the summary of it on iFanboy and then get the trade.
There you go.
That was probably his best series, which was kind of a fun. I think Pascal Ferry was on art.
That sounds right. Mystery in Space.
Something like that. And but he's not. I mean, he's not central to anyone's dreams of anything. I think he's perfect in that he's kind of known enough that if you twist him, it hurts, but not known enough that it's kind of bad casting. So to me, he fell sort of in that nice zone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it had been Captain Comet, no one would have. Like, you need some element of people to care about the twist.
So you've got that basis, and then we talk about the construction of it. Now, you know what the overall story is, but you're time jumping back and forth, and you're working with two different artists, and I wonder, like, where do you start with something like that? That's massive. And I mean, you're kind of planning like a novel, I assume, but there's other elements. Like, are you laying out the plans for it? Are you working with Mitch and Doc on that? Or, like, where do you start?
First, we settled on the Darwin. I feel like it's shitty talking about Darwin Cook with you, because you know Darwin much better than I ever knew him. But it was new. We stole a New Frontier Darwin grid, which is the sort of the three panel grid. Mm-hmm. Which I think 90% of people who read New Frontier Darwin is such a good storyteller that they don't even realize he's using a grid.
Yeah.
And once we sort of had that, all right, this is going to sound pretentious, but I'll be a little fucking pretentious. But I had never read Love and Rockets before. That just had escaped my comic knowledge. And I was like, okay, I want to go back and read this. So I was reading Love and Rockets, especially the Jaime stuff. And it's hard to read Love and Rockets at first. I don't know if you've gone back into it.
I never made it past the first book, but I had it's one of those things, like, I know this is better than what I'm experiencing it, but I hadn't put the time into it. You know what I mean? Like, there's no way that this many people regard it this highly and they're wrong and I'm not getting it for some reason. Like, anyway, yes, go ahead.
Yes, it's one of those things where you have to have faith that it's good. You can't just, like, start off reading a few pages and be like, why am I being drawn to the story? And one of the reasons that happens is because Jaime doesn't do transitions between his panels. He'll be like, he'll skip 5 years between two panels, and you'll have two different characters that haven't appeared for 50 issues talking to each other. And you're like, what is... It's jarring and it's hard storytelling. But as I was reading it, it was like washing over me. I was like, oh, I kind of like this, because I'd already done these very... You know, I'm doing it again in most of the projects I'm writing now, but at least at that time when I was starting those things, I was like, I want to do mid-page transitions where we don't tell the audience the transition's coming, like Jaime Hernandez says. I just think there's something brilliant about it, and there's something nice about contrasting two panels like that. So that was the other thing. I was like, okay, we're going to do three panel grids, and we're not going to have page flip transitions. So, like, Doc is on page one, Mitch is on page two. We're going to do, like, panel to panel. So it's like, you know, Mitch will do 1.1, and then Doc will do 1.2, and then Mitch will do 1.3, and that kind of thing.
And that was built into the scripts?
And that was built into the scripts, yeah. Jesus. So I would write the scripts, and since they were all in the three panel, I mean, I the rule was for Mr. Miracle, we had a rule that the scripts could not be, it was all nine panel grids until we broke the nine panel in issue 11. For this one, we're like, okay, we can break the three panels, and we can break them into nine panels, or you can break them into six panels, you know, basically other versions of the grid. You couldn't break them into like eight panels.
It's like, I think of it like, there's like a New York City apartment. Like, you've got this size, it works like the railroad. You can put in a weird wall over here if you want to, but it's still going to be the same basic thing.
Yeah, that's right. So we could do nine panels, we could do six, we could do, you know, three on top, two in the bottom, so you could do five. But as long as it's sort of, yeah, exactly, like a New York, yeah, exactly.
The railroad.
And because of that, I could just be like, I mean, it's super easy. I'm not fucking that smart, but I was like, okay, you know, Every page is going to be, you know, panel one, panel two, panel three. If I do 1.1, that's if I do 1.1 and 1.2, that means panel one is divided in half. If I do 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, that means panel one is divided in threes. And then I just, when I finish the script, I put Doc next to the Doc pages and Mitch next to the Mitch pages and panels and sent them off. And then what the guys did. No, you have to imagine, Mitch and, like, this could not be done among artists who are not as close as Mitch and Doc. Those guys have been together for 15 years as best friends.
Right.
Even though they don't live together, but Doc's in Michigan and Mitch is in Arizona. But by the way, I know both of them because I found them on the iFanboy boards. That's where I first saw both Mitch and Doc, because they are part of Twart, which was you guys were
promoting. That was huge around that time.
Yeah.
That was when I learned about comic art, basically. So yeah, they came along at the same time.
That's how I became fans of both of their arts. I want to work with every Twart artist. I worked with, I think, like most of them, like 75% maybe. I'll never get Gabriel Hardman because he only writes for himself.
I did a four pager with Gabriel Hardman.
So you're ahead of me. Fine. Yeah.
No one's ever read it, but I did it. I'm looking at a page on the wall right now. That felt so good to tell you. Can I just say, like, I don't have a lot, but you're saying it. As you're saying it, I am looking at the page, and I was like, oh, I did.
See? Fine. Shove it in my face. I did it.
Anyway. Did you work with Somni?
Yeah, so that worked. Never worked with Somni. He's been off in Kirkman Land for, like, last three years. But I would love to. I never even got a sketch from Somni. Ugh, I waited in line once forever, and it was just like the guy in front of me got the last.
Wait, hold on. Let me just turn around here. Oh, there it is. Oh, there it is up on the wall. You can tell what a keen eye for pop culture I have, because I have a sketch of Paul Crocker from Queen and Country. That's what I decided on.
That is so incredibly 2007.
It's so good. It's earlier than that, I think. It's so good, though. I'll send you a picture of it. It just, he drew like files on the desk, and like there's just a couple of quick lines that indicate what it is, but the way that he does things, it's just, it's beautiful. I love it.
So good.
By the way, you just heard me talk about a sketch of a minor character from a minor series, and what I talked about was the files on his desk that he drew. That's
how you tell stories. It's the little things that make it come to life.
Mm-hmm.
I knew you were talking about. Where were we? Anyways, yeah. So artists, they worked. Yeah. So Mitch and Doc worked. I mean, what my understanding was, and you can ask, but they would both get the scripts, and then they would tear out the other person's part. So they wouldn't even read the other person's.
Oh wow.
They would really and be like, okay, what am I drawing here? And then a few times, I mean, less than 10 times throughout the whole thing, they'd be like, what are you drawing on this panel just so I don't overlap with you or something? But very few times. And then, so they also were coloring themselves.
See, I thought you were going to say that they like worked together to make sure the compositions match each other. But that's not clearly
not
the case. It was
very done independently, except for a few exceptions, like I said, under 10. And they would color themselves, and at the end, Doc would send his pages to Mitch, and Mitch would do sort of the final computer work to merge the pages, mm-hmm. and then send them to DC. And then the poor DC had to figure out how to pay them, because, you know, sometimes they had a third of a page, and sometimes they had, you know, one-fifth of a page, and all those sort of things. And the most tempting thing was the 9-panel grid, which Ethan drawing every other panel, was like the most tempting thing to use, because that's so powerful. But I had to, again, save that for issue 11, when the final shot sort of happened.
That would have been a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, so when you're building like I think I talked to Matt Rosenberg about this, is that one of the things that sort of astounds me, and this would come into play in Rorschach True too, is the idea of writing a mystery story in that way. I find it incredibly, feels so challenging. Like I don't like mysteries sometimes, because I'm like, I don't know if I could do that, and I think that bothers me. Just because.
Me too. Same.
Well, you've got this whole thing where you know the answer, and you've got to tease it out in just the right way, and you don't want to blow it, and it just feels like such a. That's so hard to do in a way that's going to come across. You kind of just got to trust yourself entirely to do it. But you know, you've done this a few times or whatever. But like, do you feel like there's parts where you're trying not to give away things too early, but also not hide them, and you know, like whether that's working, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's bits, several issues before the quote unquote reveal. You know, you've got Adam Strange acting very off putting, and I think between you and the art, like it comes across completely now that I know. But at the time, when I'm, you know, you're reading it originally, you're like, this is very strange, and it's very cinematic in that way. I mean, is that a thing you're planning for? You're always sort of doing that balance and hoping it works.
Yeah, and inevitably your audience, I mean, I had the lucky, I don't know if you call it lucky, but I had this thing where people always, they thought they knew me well enough to know where I was going with a story at this point. Mm-hmm. So, like, they didn't notice how broken Adam was and sort of the bad things he did, because they just assumed he was another Scott Free, and I was telling that same story. So it was nice to use sort of the assumptions about and not just about me, but about Mitch and I did, about like, oh, this is a Tom Mitch story about sadness and redemption. And to use that as the twist. But it did, you know, an issue would come out and be like, okay, now it's on the table. Now everyone knows Adam's evil. And then people would be like, maybe Adam's not evil. I'd be like, no, he's definitely evil.
I mean, I did that. I was like, oh, there must be another thing. Well, it's interesting that you said this about Hernandez brothers, is that you know, at the beginning, you just have to trust them. And I feel like I think of your work that way. Like, I have to understand, like, in the beginning, I don't understand this, and that's okay. That's how it's supposed to be. But I know that I trust you that something's, you know, at the very least, I know that it will be thoughtful and it will be worked out. You know, and it's a risk for you and it's a risk for the readers, but like, you know, you can build that thing over time, but you know, it's scary. Like, it means that you have to trust readers a lot more than I would, I think is what I'm getting. But, you know, obviously there's enough people who are getting it and dig it. But like, are you aware of that? Like at the beginning, like nobody's going to understand a damn thing about this until issue 4.
I feel like I'm so, I mean, I always want to say people, I was like, have you ever read a Grant Morrison comic? I don't understand a fucking thing that's happening.
Yes.
These things. And everyone calls, and everyone be like, no, trust Grant Morrison. He knows the secret to life. And there's genius behind these panels. And so I always feel like, oh, at least I'm not doing that. I feel like I'm one tone down from that. But yeah, I mean, I have faith in a comic book audience, and I have faith that when the trade, I mean, you're not writing for a trade, but your legacy is going to be the trade. The issues only last so long.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder how what you were saying, you know, you swerved basically because they'd seen the other things that had come before it, and on this one you did the opposite. Now that only works now. Unless everybody who ever reads your stuff reads it in the order it came out. I don't think that'll make it worse, but it did occur to me.
That's true. Well, hopefully it works independently as a story. God, I don't know. You can only knock on wood. Some of it is faith. Some of it's happy accidents.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I imagine that's sort of the trick about eventually you're just like, oh, I'll just jump off this cliff. I've always landed before, which is how I've described my adulthood. But you know, with your stories, that's what you're doing to a certain extent, although you get to understand the machinations of them more as you go through them. I don't think Grant Morrison does. I think he's just like, here it is. It's great. I don't know.
Here's a good example from Strange Adventures. So before I started writing each issue, I would ask Doc and Mitch, like, what do you want to draw for this issue? Like, is there something you're dying to draw? You just got inspired. You want to draw. And poor Doc, was stuck on Rand the whole time. And I think he got bored out of his mind fucking that. He's like, oh, I can't. I talked to him about this. He's like, I can't draw this goddamn Finn anymore. He's just like, I want it. And on issue 3 or 4, he's like, can I draw Superman? Can I draw Green Lantern? And I was like, how am I going to get Superman to the store? So I had like him go to Earth and ask Superman, like, hey, will you come help me? And he asks Hal Jordan, hey, will you? And both of them are like, for different reasons. Like, no, dude, Rand has to solve this problem themselves. We can't sort of fight their war for them, or else we'd be fighting 1,000 wars. And at the time, like, I put that in just because Doc really wanted Superman. Those were good beats, but he wanted to draw Superman and Green Lantern, so I wanted to put that in. When we got to the end of the story, I was facing this dilemma where I was like, I set up this whole story, but I was like, I see a plot hole in my story. I was like, why didn't he just go to Superman and Green Lantern be like, shit, these guys are about to take over my planet. And then I was like, oh, shit, I actually had those scenes in. Thank God. I put those in issue 3 where he actually did the thing that it plugged that plot hole that I was so afraid of. And I was like, oh, that's such – sometimes the story gods are kind to you. That was like one of those good examples of the story gods being kind, where it was like I could – if someone was like, what? This would never happen because he just asked Superman for help. I was like, I literally had a scene where he asked Superman for help and Superman said no.
What a dick, Superman.
Makes sense to me. That's a good reason.
Is a really good. Yeah, I think it's interesting that you because I tend to think of these things as pretty tightly plotted, and you've got so much room, and you're trying to get to a point to be able to say like, what is it you want to draw, and have room for something like that. I wouldn't have thought you'd been able to do that on these. Like, I know that happens in, you know, month to month comics. Because you just like, what do you want to do? I want horse races. Okay, alien horses. You know, like no artist has ever asked for horse races. But either way. That you were able to do that and have that freedom. That's interesting.
I mean, generally speaking in comics, if you know your theme and know your plot, if the artist wants to draw something, you should be able to sort of mold them around that. That's just been my general experience. It's funny, the doc stuff probably changed the most. The Mitch stuff probably is exactly what I envisioned from day one to the end. Except I really liked how Mitch was brought Alana to life, so it probably made her more cool than I sort of had originally intended. But the doc stuff, at the beginning, Doc was supposed to draw sort of more of an ideal, more of the idea that he was like drawing the lie. That was sort of my original idea. Yeah. Doc will draw the lie, Mitch will draw the truth. And very quickly it became, because I always think of Doc as being, even though I've worked with him before, I know this is not true, it's almost like it's hard to escape. Like, Doc draws sort of the ideal Silver Age stuff. He does this stuff with Parker where he like taps into that stuff so brilliantly, and I like the Shazam series and in the Johnny Quest stuff. And but like very quickly I realized like Doc wanted to get bloody. He wanted to get dirty. He wanted to draw. like around issue 3, I was like, oh, it looks beautiful, but he wants to tell some mean stuff. And Doc had created, like, I had done very little world building for Ran. I was just like, Ran, it's a stupid planet with, you know, it's a sci-fi Star Trek planet. Who cares? And Doc is like, okay, here are the 7 like different types of alien tribes. Here's their design. Here's where they live. Here's this. And he did that map, which was he did that on his own. Mm-hmm. That appears in issue 10 or 11. And he's like, this is a map of the world. This is where everyone lives. And I was like, oh, so at that point I was like, okay, we're going to change our plans because Doc will actually just draw what actually happened to Adam, but we'll have gaps where we don't see the actual betrayal. Because if Doc and I had stayed inside that box it takes him, it's a 2-year journey. That would just fucking, that would ruin 2 years of his life. You know, like that's not, whatever my original plan was, it's not worth Doc's life for 2 years. And it's not worth alienating artists I want to work with in the future and a personal friend of mine. So when I saw that he wanted to go in that direction, I adjusted the story.
Mm-hmm. He is, I think, if not the, at least top 3 most underutilized artists in comics. Like Connor and I talk about this all the time. Like, we don't understand why you don't immediately put him on Superman or whatever the hell he wants to draw. I don't understand. It does not make sense. I'm sure you have been privy to conversations. You know things that I don't, but that is my feeling, that he's woefully underappreciated.
I wouldn't say he's underappreciated because I appreciate him.
Sure, and no, obviously you do.
And he gets a ton of love. I mean, he can post a picture up there and get 3,000 likes every day of his life because he just draws people's dreams of superheroes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's nowhere for Doc to go but up. I mean, he could be the next. I mean, he draws like a modern day Darwin Cook, but it's not like he's copying what Darwin did. Darwin did something different. But he captures that sort of essentialism of DC Comics better than many, many artists.
There's just a joy and a beauty in that line of his. He's just got an amazing line, and yeah, he does. He captures that thing that, to me, is the thing that DC should be trying to be.
I agree.
What is it about these superheroes? Well, that's what they should look like. It's all right there in that picture. So let us move over, and we will talk about Rorschach. Probably for less time, but what do I know?
That's a much more complicated series. Just in terms
really,
of
do you look at it that way? I mean, I guess it's more panels.
Yeah, it's a lot more panels. I think it's more complicated. Strange Adventures feels more like a straight line. Rorschach is definitely a sort of jagged kind of thing.
And did that? I mean, were you offered like, hey, you want to do a Rorschach story or like, do you have something in Watchmen you'd like to do? Like, where does this one start?
So DiDio, when he was, Dan DiDio used to be editor in chief of DC Comics for many, many years. And he had gone to some meeting before the Watchmen TV show come out where they were like, Watchmen is now a brand and we're going to make money off of it. And Mitch and I were just finishing Mr. Miracle and he texted me and he said, Mitch, and I think I had pitched him Strange Adventures at that point. He's like, fuck Adam Strange. Because Dan's job is to sell comic books, and Adam Strange is not the biggest selling comic book. And if you're like, yeah, Mr. Terrific's in it too. Oh my God, no. It's like, fuck Adam Strange. And Rorschach, you and Mitch. Like, you guys are coming off this big Mr. Miracle thing. I'm going to put you on a big character. We're going to make big money. That was his basic idea. And I was like, not only no, but hell no. Why would I ever want to fucking do that? I was like, I'm already kind of like the diet Alan Moore, you know? I'm like the RC Cola of Alan Moore, yeah?
Did you come up with that or did somebody call you that?
No, that's all me.
Okay.
But maybe Alan Moore probably told me once in my face, but I blocked it out because I have psychological defense. No, that came up with it. So I was like, why would I ever want to go head to head with the guy? You know, that seems like an absolute idiot thing to do.
But
it would be like Justin Timberlake being like, hey, Marvin Gaye, can I sing all your songs? You know, would be like just. But so that happened. I said no.
I agree with that analogy, by the way. Not that you are. I just like the Marvin Gaye versus Alan Moore. Anyway, just I'm with you. I didn't want you to think that fell on flat ears.
Thanks, brother. And so two things happened after that changed my mind. Number one, the TV show came out, and the TV show was like important and good. And we all thought it was just going to be Watchmen, but divided into more parts. Like that was, I don't know why, but I thought that was true.
It was from out of nowhere.
Yeah. It was like no.
At first you're like, I don't know what this is. And then pretty soon you went, wait a minute, is this really good? And then by the end you're, I can't believe how good this is. It doesn't even make sense.
It was shocking.
What did they even make that for? That's what I kept asking. Who is this for? Because I guess you could enjoy it if you didn't know Watchmen, but if you knew Watchmen, like Jesus, it was a delight.
I watched it once myself, you know, when we all watched it, and then my wife was like, I heard about it, so I went and watched it with my wife. She maybe read Watchmen once, but she's not like us, you know, where every Same. Panel meets something. And she's like, yeah, she was really into it. She's like, I want to know what happened next.
Same here.
What?
Like Lindsay had read it, you know, 15 years prior or whatever, and liked it, but whatever, never thought about it again. And then, yeah, we were like, we would watch it together every Sunday night. It was insane. Okay, so you saw that.
So I saw that, and I want to be honest, but like the best way to express it is very cliche, but it's like, oh, Watchmen is not just that same story over and over again. Watchmen is like a language, you know. It was like Alan Moore gave us like letters we could type with, you know, like a different, and we don't have to tell his story with those letters. Like
I'll say it. Before Watchmen tried to fill in a bunch of stuff that we didn't necessarily need to know, and therefore most of it was forgettable because we didn't need to know it. The thoughts of Josh on Watchmen before Watchmen have nothing to do with those of DC Comics or AT&T Enterprises or Tom King.
I was afraid that if I wrote a story about Watchmen, it would just be like a bad cover song.
Yeah.
And I was really like, oh no, I can use those same notes to make a different song. Mm-hmm. So that happened. And then the second thing that happened was, and I can say this now because DC management has kind of moved on, was that DC management did not like Jorge's art, Jorge Fornes. And I had just worked out with him on this Batman annual. And I got in the art for the Batman Annual 4, which I think is maybe one of my favorite issues I've ever written. And I was like, oh, he's a genius. It's like, you know, like that happens every once in a while. You're getting in art from a guy who's kind of new, and you're like, oh, no, wait, I've got one of those geniuses on my hands. Mm-hmm. How interesting. And I was like, I want to work with Jorge. And they're like, you cannot because we don't like his art. He just looks like Mazzucchelli. And I was like, yes, he looks like Mazzucchelli. Why would that be a bad thing? Mazzucchelli is one of the greatest artists that ever touched a pencil. And I knew they wanted me to do this Rorschach project. And I was like, I bet if I agree to do it and I say I'll only do it with Jorge, they will say yes. And so Jorge would have to be like, he was starting to get those Daredevil offers from Chip. Marvel was starting to pull it in with exclusives. And I was like, I got to act fast. And I was like, I'll do Rorschach if I can get Jorge. And they said, okay, yeah. Well, if Tom finally agreed to say yes on Rorschach, little did they know I'd write this sort of obscure little Rorschach. They thought I'd write, you know, the next big Before Watchmen thing.
Have they read your stuff?
I don't know if anyone reads comics anymore, Josh. That's fair. Yeah,
listen, go with it as long as you can get it. I'm not.
You and I read comics. We're the last dinosaurs. And so that's the genesis. That's a long story, is to say the genesis of, like, okay, I got from Hell No Watchmen to, okay, I'll write a Rorschach series.
And then this one is, I mean, I don't want to say it's a straight up mystery, but it's basically a mystery. There's a lot of stuff going on. And I can say I had no idea what it was going to be. And at the end, I don't think I saw any of that coming. And what I want to know is, actually, you know what? This has to do with both of them. And you have mentioned Silver Age creators a bunch of times. You know, you're obviously up to date on the history of these creators and the characters and things like that. And so throughout the back end of Strange Adventures, there's quotes from creators who are not necessarily household names. You know, there's an Al Feldstein quote, I think. There's a Gil Kane quote at one point. And then in this book, you have, you know, you have Frank Miller, and you have other real comic book, you know, people, real people, creators from history. You know, is this just where you're at now? Like, you're thinking about this history all the time? Has that always been an element of what you're thinking about?
I don't know where I'm at now, but it's definitely where I was at two or three years ago when I conceived these comics. I mean, you could, like I said when we started this off, like I figure I know how to write comics. I have that piece, and it's like looking for the inspiration. Usually the inspiration is what you're obsessed with on the side. It's like what you know, it's like life is what you do during recess or whatever the fuck that phrase is. And at that time I was obsessed with two things. I was obsessed with old noir movies. I was watching them constantly, and I was obsessed with comic book history. Mm-hmm. And I was like reading, like if I just wanted to be like, okay, I want to escape my world, I would go and read issues of the Comics Journal from 1982.
Wow.
Just cover to cover, and be like, man, these guys would have hated everything I do. I love it. So I became obsessed with all these, like, usually it was stuff before I was born, Bronze Age, Silver Age stuff, right. Not like the stuff from when I was, I've never been nostalgic about my own childhood for some reason. I'm nostalgic for my parents' childhood. Other things I would do, I would go back and watch old iFanboy Comic-Con videos. Goddamn, those are fun. If you're ever bored, go on YouTube and watch those. You guys were – it's so funny to see, like, baby Robert Kirkman. And, like, everyone has so much hair and we're all thin. It's awesome.
I didn't know what I was doing.
It was great. You were a great interview, viewer. Fantastic.
Thank you. I mean, I guess sort of my question is, when I'm seeing that stuff, I am looking for some symbolism. So when the quotes are in the back of Strange Adventures, I'm thinking, well, what does this mean? And you know, you've got the characters in the middle of the Rorschach story, and I'm, what is this supposed to be saying to me? And what I'm wondering is, I guess you're just like, I thought that shit was cool, so I put it there.
Yeah, it's like, was it Mulholland Drive, where the first time you watch it, you're like, oh my God, there's so much incredible symbolism here. And then someone tells you, oh, that was a TV pilot that they never did the second issue, never did the second episode of. So you're like, oh, wait. I mean, for Strange Adventures, the idea was, if you look at those, it's not just that I'm quoting comic book creators, they're all artists.
Yeah.
Every single one of them is a Silver Age artist. These are guys who are drawing. And so the first connection was, this is an art-driven book. I was like, I have, in my opinion, two of, like, the best top five artists in comics working on the same book at the same time. And so that was just one call out to be like, I want to give artists a voice, because this book is about giving these people the room to be creative and to draw. And the second part is, most of those quotes sort of revolve around the difference between the idealist of what these guys were doing. They were drawing these ideal worlds. And not just guys, because, you know, Marie Severin's in there and Ramona mm-hmm. Fraiden's in there. Yeah. Guy tried so hard to get a Matt Baker quote, but no one ever interviewed him. And the difference between them creating these idealized worlds and living themselves in the real world. Mm-hmm. And that's what the book was about. It was about the difference between people who create, about telling stories about beauty while living in the ugly of the reality. And so that's what the general quote was about. It was about the distance of people who create ideal worlds who live in the reality of, and in our reality with the reality of comics.
And the only way you're going to find that is if, for fun, you read old issues of the Comics Journal cover to cover. Because that's not easy stuff to find.
Well, to me it makes sense. And I feel like...
I'm just impressed that you found enough to be able to do that in each of them. I think that that's... And that is 100% the most fascinating thing about creators of those eras. And did you read Hey Kids Comics by Howard Chaykin?
Yes, I read the first volume. I didn't read the second one.
The second's almost more of the same, but it really is. It is another one because, like, who the hell enjoys this except me? Like, right. Every time Connor and I talk about it, it's like, we can't imagine anyone else is reading this. He's not making money off this. There's no way.
I would very much enjoy it.
Oh, it's just, it's... And for us, a lot of it is like, I know they're all analogs to real people, and I'm kind of annoyed that he won't say, but we get to play the mystery game of like, I think that's Neil Adams. I'm not sure. You know, I think. But yeah. That's
no, I mean, it's amazing if you look back at these. Like, my favorite artist in the whole world is Alex Toth. And that guy, I just think he draws more, like, as a guy who put pen to paper in comics, I just think he draws more beautifully than anyone else. And that guy lived a miserable life where he ended up very much with OCD, where he didn't leave his, I mean, he'd be perfect for now, but he didn't leave his apartment, he didn't leave his house for like 15 years at the end. And like, he had stacks of papers and, you know, he just died alone listening to Rush Limbaugh, you know? Yeah. And she's just like, the difference between, like, if you look at his art of just like, I'm going to draw this ideal, this beautiful 30s, gorgeous world and bring that into the 50s and the 60s and connect it all to modernism, and him being stuck in his house being like, I can't get out. I mean, to me, that tension that there is just, I mean, that's the beauty of our medium. It goes back to Frank Miller. I was talking to Frank about this. Or I wasn't talking to him, but I was doing an interview for a documentary about Frank, and his partner, who was directing the movie, invited me up to a hotel room to sort of do my interview, and I'm there in a suit, and she's asking me a question like what comics is and what comics isn't, and, you know, we're talking about sort of all the ideals of comics, and then I was like, but at the end of the day, people forget that comics is like a deadline medium. It's not a meeting about people making the best they can make. Nobody here is like Picasso. We're people who are trying to make something for a paycheck. And Frank Miller, who I had no idea was in the hotel, jumped out from the other room and was like, exactly, finally someone fucking said it. I never felt more better about myself in my life. He's like, yes, we're a deadline medium. We're not this idealist bullshit. Like, we have to turn in our stuff.
The magic comes from the people who are doing that in spite of that.
Yes.
Although I don't usually think it's intentional. That's my guess. Anyway, because you're just doing the thing you do. And anyway, that has nothing to do. So is that, you know, I guess, is that how we're, so how does this relate to those appearances in the Rorschach book?
I mean, it's a lot of sort of forces came together to sort of, Rorschach himself as a character who lives in the Watchmen universe is a commentary, yes, is a second degree commentary on Steve Ditko, right? Mm-hmm. Like, obviously Watchmen itself is both about the Cold War and all that stuff, but it's also about the process of making comics. So much to the extent that Joe Orlando is a character in Watchmen, although he only appears in the auxiliary material, but he's there. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who's drawing the pirate comics. And also, Gil Kane appears in the comic. He's not called Gil Kane, but it's so obviously him. And he's the guy who, like, designs the monster at the end, and then he gets blown up in a boat while trying to hit on a girl.
What's funny is that you're like, it's so obviously him. I was like, I've literally never heard anybody say that. But I haven't read it in not such a long time, but long enough so that I might recognize things I might not have before. But don't tell me that when you were like 12, you know, or 50, whenever it is, and you're like, oh, this fucking Gil Kane. Come on, who are you trying to fool here, Dave?
No, yeah, no. But when you get to the white-haired, skinny, handsome comic book artist guy who's a little arrogant, and you're like, oh, okay, Gil Kane. But when I think about Rorschach, I think about Steve Ditko. I can't sort of separate those two people, at least in my head. And it's weird because Rorschach is a parody of Mr. A, who is a parody of Steve Ditko. So it's not like a direct but it's all connected. So in the very beginning of when I was, because I didn't want to write about Walter Kovacs, because I didn't want to, Alan Moore's story about what happens to Walter Kovacs is done. Like, yeah. It's perfect. And I didn't want to write about what the sort of Jeff had created, was sort of son of Rorschach, using this psychologist's son. I wanted to write about just a completely different guy who kind of thought he was Rorschach. I was trying to figure out who this character was, and I was like, the connection. And then I was again going through comics journals, and I was reading about Steve Ditko, and they had printed a whole issue on Steve Ditko, and they printed his, not just his Mr. A pages, but like the stuff that even came later in like the 90s and stuff, sort of his, this, when he, Steve Ditko at the end of, not the end of his life, but near the end of his life, like to defend himself, he would write in, not to, I'm sure he'd be published in the New York Times, but he would write into like the most obscure fanzines, and he would write like, you know, 5-page single spaced essays on why fucking comics suck. And then he would accompany with him with like these illustrations, and they are just like Unabomber crazy. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at these like bizarre drawings he did and these like long encomiums. And I was like, this guy is Rorschach. I was like, it's, I was like, this is absolutely amazing. But Alan Moore had sort of covered the sort of positivism, the sort of Ayn Rand of it all. And I was like, what if there was a guy that was like this, but wasn't obsessed with Ayn Rand, but was obsessed with Hannah Arendt, who's like an exact contemporary of Ayn Rand, who also comes from Germany, also comes to America, but it's on the left and not the right. I was like, oh, I know that sort of appealed to me. So it would be like Ditko, but like a mirror image of him from the other way. So who's not obsessed with this woman, but obsessed with a different female philosopher. And then I started studying Hannah Arendt, and then that sort of took off from there. Frank Miller.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where that started.
And so then you just kept adding in other comics folk. And it's been a little while since I read it, so I don't quite remember all the details. But it's a certain point, it's like, there are a lot of people here who are real people. Like, so when did you decide to put Frank Miller in it?
So I was reading Bill Shelley's biography of Otto Binder. For people who don't know, Otto Binder was a very early pulp sci-fi writer who came on to Captain Marvel near the beginning and did some of the seminal work there, creating like Mary Marvel and stuff. And then created super DC, like was like, we want Mary Marvel. That's a big success. Let's hire the guy who did it and have him do it over here. And that's how Supergirl got born.
Interesting.
So I was reading the biography of this, of Otto Binder, and later in life, just the same stuff we were talking about with Alex, you and I have met a lot of older comic book creators, and it's a similar story. But up until very, very recently, once you hit 50 in comics, you had a kind of not nice life.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not, people like Bendis and Mark Miller are kind of trailblazing, like you can be successful after 50 now, which, thank God, right?
Yeah.
But that didn't.
You're getting there.
I know, right? I know. I'm following. I'm just looking at him like, okay, Netflix, save me. You know, you're like, but it used to be, and the same thing happened to Bob Binder. You know, as he got older, sort of his, you know, he got less and less work, and he became, and then the tragic thing that happened was, so Supergirl and Mary Marvel are based on his daughter. You know, he was kind of this old, by all accounts and pictures, old sort of a flubby guy, and he had this sort of almost gorgeous angelic daughter who he idealized, and when she was 16 she was hit by a bus and killed, which is horrible, and that kind of broke him for the rest of his life, where he kind of became this kind of sad figure. And then so I was reading this book, and then at one point in his sort of later life he became obsessed with UFOs, and he became obsessed with the concept of listening to magnetic tape to see if UFOs and or the dead were communicating with him, sort of like spirits. And as part of that, he held a seance in 1963 or something. And some very nerdy people who were like the original fan fanzine people were like, we love Ottobinder, he's awesome, you know, he invented this. They came out and he's like, you're coming to my house, you know, just to nerd out before cons. And he's like, hey, you guys want to do a seance with me? And they're like, let's do it. And they recorded the seance because they had a recording, so they were going to interview him. And so it was these two fans, and they brought along with them another fan at that time, a 16-year-old kid from Vermont who happened to be Frank Miller. And I'm reading this, and I'm like, what? I was like, Frank Miller went to a seance with Otto Binder? I was like, that's an amazing thing. And there's an actual transcript of it. And Bill Shelley in that book has the transcript of Otto Binder reaching out and reaching. And what he did was he would turn on the tape, just like as in Rorschach, and he would reach out and be like, can I speak to my daughter? He was obsessed with his dead daughter. And he would wait for his daughter to respond. And then he would ask each person to go around and speak to a dead person. Frank asks to speak to his grandmother. And they would listen, and then they would just the tape would play, and then he'd play it back, and they'd listen to the little crackles in the tape, and they'd be like, "Oh, you hear that crackle there? That's your grandma talking to you." And I was listening, and I'm reading this, and I'm like, "So they're just listening to these crackles, and they're hearing what they want to hear, and whoever hears, you know, tells you more about yourself than what the crackle is." I was like, "It's a fucking Rorschach test." it's almost like the gift of story gods dropped this in my lap, right?
Jesus, well, good pick. I mean, you grab that one out of the air.
So yeah, so then I was like, okay, then I'll. So that's how I got to sort of.
So I wanted to do something. That's a real thing.
That's a real thing that really happened. Yeah.
Wow.
And one of the real joys of Rorschach was when I was trying to convince Frank to do the book. I called him. You know, usually you talk to Frank's people, his team, or whatever. But I know Frank. We're friends. You know, not like super close, but we you know, we have dinner if we're in town together. And I was talking to Frank on the phone, and I was so nervous because at one point he's like, you got to send me the pages, you know, so I can read myself in this book. And I was like, just to give you some background, I was like, this references this thing that happened when you're six. And I expect him to be like, that didn't happen, Tom. That's a total lie. You know, he could have totally ruined my book. But he's like, oh my God, I haven't thought about that in 50 years. Yeah, it was insane. And he's like, yeah, my grandmother had just passed and I wanted to. And he started telling this story about how when he met Otto Binder, he's like, it was so sad because he was obviously broken because his daughter had died. And we just kind of sat there humoring him because he was just so depressed about the death of his daughter. And I was like, oh, my God, this is just an amazing story. And so to hear, you know, to read it once in a book, but then have Frank say it, this happened, was just amazing.
Who reads that book? Like, I'm not even being facetious. Like, that's one of those things like that sounds fascinating. And. But who's the audience for that? It can't be that many people. What's the book?
It's Bill Shelley's biography of Otto Binder. Bill Shelley wrote a bunch of – Bill Shelley passed away recently. He was one of the original sort of what do they call them? The fans, you know, the like Roy Thomas, the original guys, that first generation of fans. Bill Shelley wrote a series of books. He did. There's a biography of what else? Who else did he do? He did Warren from Warren Publishing, and he did Joe Kubert. And I think the reason I read the Otto Binder one is the only one that was on tape, so I could listen to it on Audible while I was driving my kids to school. That's how I picked that one out of the bunch. But they're very good. It was very sad that he passed.
It's what's mostly sad is how sad all those stories are. You know, like you know, you get Alex Toth and Steve Ditko. Well, Steve Ditko didn't die, but he didn't live to a certain extent.
Yes,
Wally Wood, and you know, it just goes on and on.
Yes. So that's how Frank got into the book.
And. I mean,
but the legal stuff is a whole other fucking.
Yeah, I know. As I was thinking that, I thought, and
there's a link to Adam Strange because Otto Binder, he invented the first android, and his name was Adam Link. Now that's a weird name to us today, but back then Adam just meant man. Mm-hmm. It doesn't as much anymore. So that just like man with computer word, and of course that's Adam Strange, Adam Link. It's all just that's where it's stolen from. So there's Adam Strange.
There you go. But yeah, so. I guess pulling back a little, that's a lot of things to pull into what would be a Rorschach story. This is not the blockbuster that Dan DiDio envisaged, clearly.
No, it was this small story about comics and paranoia and no Walter Kovacs and no squid monsters. And it was something different and told with the, Citizen Kane storytelling technique and that whole thing. Mm-hmm.
Was it like, did you have it envisaged when you started? Did it turn out the way that you sort of pictured it, or did it turn into a different thing? Because I feel like it, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but I feel like it started in one place and became a very different type of thing. Were you aware of the beat of what happens at the, and I don't remember any characters' names ever, at the end, you know, where the investigator, yeah, or
they kill President
Columbo.
Yeah.
That's what Connor calls him. you had those beats, but sort of in the middle, I was going to use meander, but I don't mean that in a negative way. There's just a lot there.
It is. It's a lot. No, I mean, the story was always from the beginning was a detective investigates an attempted murder or attempted assassination. And during the investigation, he realizes that the assassination was justified and he carries it out. That was always sort of the plot. Mm-hmm. And the Rorschach of that all is like, he's seeing all these pieces of the puzzle and there's different ways to read it. And what you read, it says more about you than him. And it sort of becomes his idea. Cause you don't know anything about the detective, except there's like one thing revealed about him in the 12 issues, except that he looks like Columbo. that becomes his personality. The story becomes him. He becomes the Rorschach test. That was always the intention for it to go the way it went.
Did you always think this way, or has this developed more finely? And no, I'm just a genuine question, because when I talk to folks who write comics for a living and you're in it, you know, there's sort of ways of thinking about story he's the Rorschach, and what I think is that's brilliant. It's obvious. But you don't see it until, you know, like recognizing it is the brilliant part, I think. You know, was that always there? Or do you just have terminology for it? Or could you talk like this when you were, you know, 18?
I mean, not to suck up to you so much, but a lot of my comics were formed from listening to people like you guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, listening to iFanboy, listening to... we've talked about this before, yeah, but I was obsessed with comic podcasts in the aughts, less so now because I just don't want to hear them talking about me. But you guys, being same age as me and looking back on these comics and being like, let's look at them on a deeper level, was a huge influence. But also the comics I've always loved since I was a kid. I mean, I love Watchmen. I love such a fucking generic DKR. I love Squadron Supreme by Mark Gruenwald, which has like this horribly depressing ending. I love 5 Year Later Legion, which is this like, those comics I've always loved are the ones who are like, you think heroes are great, but actually heroes are kind of a little flawed. It probably goes back to my dad in the ponytail and taking me to the fucking, I mean, it's not like I'm deep psychological.
Well, I mean, you know, it's so easy to, when you, you know, you roll your eyes at Dark Knight Returns, but in a way, like, yes, it's cliched, but it's one of those ones that's for a reason. You know, it's really, there is a lot there. And it's one of those things that I think it's actually just so good that people enjoy it on all sorts of different levels, because the world isn't going to be, nothing is going to be made into a bestseller because it is deeply thoughtful and you know, layered necessarily. That's going to help, and that's going to help it stick around. But I think that that's one of those, you don't get a lot of things that are both critically profound and also wildly popular. Like, I feel like we used to have that all, you know, like movies like The Godfather, like, oh, this is all of the things, or Jaws or whatever.
Yeah.
And comics, you know, get harder. It's like you're either one thing or the other, but, you know, those are examples of, like, I said this about the show, but I still don't understand this about the comic. Like, I don't understand why Watchmen is a perennial seller to the larger public. I don't understand it, because it's not easy to read, and it is not about it's not about the thing that you think it's about. It is, but it also is. I mean, I guess you can read it on multiple levels, but to me, I'm like, this is a text about comics. And it's strange.
It's very strange. But I was going to say, like, the nice thing about our industry and the thing that I'm going to try to trick publishers with for the rest of my life is that the top selling three books in our industry are Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns, and The Killing Joke. And they're always number one through three in American graphic novels. I mean, sometimes they get bumped off temporarily, but they always come back. And they're super ambitious, and they're super complicated, and they're super good.
And they're not. And that's not just happy for us. And none of them are like what you would think of as a superhero story. Like they don't make you feel good.
No, they don't.
And it's so strange to me. I mean, that gives me hope. I'm like, well, there must be a lot of people out there who are. Maybe there's a lot of people who are buying it and then starting to read it and then they don't finish it. But, you know, people keep buying them. It's the same thing. I thought this when you were on Batman. I thought, what are people thinking? You know, because I think at first you were like, I'll do a superhero story. And we talked before that. And then later you did your thing. You got your thing into it. And I thought, this is not what people signed up for. But, you know, it worked. There's enough people who did dig it. And I think that's really interesting. I don't give people enough credit, I guess.
But my top-selling trades are not Batman trades,
sure.
which are Vision, Mr. Miracle, and then Superman Up in the Sky, the stupid Walmart book, is my number three, which is shocking to me.
It was really good. But that is that book I was talking about, that Dark Knight and Watchmen aren't.
Yeah, that's a super happy book where like right. My wife always says the little girl dies in like the fifth page. So good job on my happy book. But Vision is you only hit that lightning in a bottle once, but Vision's a great example. Like, that's a sad book, mature, but Disney has made hundreds of millions of dollars off of that at this point because of WandaVision. Mm-hmm. So there'll always be room in comics for that because it appeals to a broader audience. But I also think it's a little bit generational. I think that's kind of depressing to us old people. We're kind of the trail end of Gen X, you know, yes. we're the end of it. And our generation was a lot about, like our parents were the kids of the 60s who had grown up in the 50s and kind of seen the facade of that. And I feel like they beat that into us in some ways. We're like, our generation was all about, there are no ideals, so we have to make up our own ideals, you know? And then those ideals have to be tested as well. We have to constantly test our ideals. I feel like that was like the 90s. And
my instinct, by the way, when you said our generation is not, and what I always think is this all there is?
Yes.
Generally that's like the thing, and I don't know if Ethan Hawke said that in Reality Bites or what, it, you know, but that's how you can tell that when you talk about like what generation you are or whatever, like I'm definitely not a millennial. I'm at the very end of Gen X, and I'm younger than, you know, we're younger than most of the people who are, but like I'm clearly part of that because of that instinct of looking at things.
Yes,
which is
that all
also
is.
We're completely okay. Forgotten. No one yes. ever talks about us. It's weird. Like the latchkey kids we were.
We were raised in front of televisions, and we were raised in front of televisions watching reruns of shows that were on 20 years ago.
Yes.
Like people don't understand. Like when I was a kid, I watched shows from the 50s and 60s and wondered why life wasn't like this anymore. Like I've seen every I Dream of Jeannie. Why? I don't know. That wasn't a fucking good show, but I saw every episode. It was always on 5:30.
Like I'm so well versed in the Brady Bunch.
Yes. The Brady Bunch. My
and
God.
Three's Company.
And yes, Three's Company. Oh, that was the one you didn't understand until you were 11. You're like, wait, they thought he was gay.
What I knew was there's something about this I like, and I have no idea what it is.
That's right.
And it was apparently tons of sexual tension. That's right. What that was. This is
it was
riveting.
Working on multiple levels.
Yep.
Yeah, we watched all that stuff. I don't know what we were
talking about to get to that, but the comics.
I think the generation above us and below us are more idealistic than we are. We're I don't know if the word is practical or cynical, but one of those two.
I think we're ready for the punch, and we have not been proven wrong.
That's true. That's
our theme. That's sort of what we're coming back around to.
Yeah, we are ready for the punch. Yeah.
I'm gonna ask about one more thing, and then I am mercifully going to let you go, and then I have to go to sleep. I'm holding off a cold right now, and you can't even hear it, which is how much fun I'm having talking.
Oh, well, you're doing great.
Supergirl came from out of nowhere for me. I did not know you were doing it. It came out, and I thought, this is strange. And I find myself, I really look forward to it. It's such an enjoyable book, and I think that I would not know it was you. And I don't know if that's a rude thing to say to a creator, you know, like, but it doesn't seem like one of the books that you normally do. And again, I always ask the question, but like, where did that come from? Where are you? You put on a road trip, you know, in a way, and it's a very different interpretation of that character that I've ever seen, which is not a lot. She's always a side character I don't pay any attention to. But how do you, where's the Supergirl book come from?
I mean, the behind the scenes stuff is that my editor on Batman was, they put me with musical chairs at DC, and he became the editor of the Superman books instead of the Batman books. And Ben Abernathy, another incredible editor, became the editor of Batman. So his name was Jamie Rich. He's since left the company. He's at the top of us now. He's a very nice guy. And he was sort of, you know, I was just talking to him. I was, you know, finishing projects. I was like, what's next? I hadn't done a book in a, like, where just an editor's like, hey, come on this book for a little while, do issues 14 through 15 through 20. And he's like, well, how about Supergirl? No one's ever done anything with that. And again, I had written so many middle-aged white guys, I was just ready to get away from that dynamic of it. And also, again, like Rorschach and Strange Adventures, this is like a year and a half after, even though they're kind of coming out concurrently, it has to do with Bilquist being sort of a faster artist. And I really was at that point, not that Biden had been elected, but it looked like, I feel like this is making this political, but I tell you, I hated the Trump era so much. I'm sorry. I just hated, it just felt, there was so much tension on us all the time. And especially with the disease and everything. And it felt like, I was like, oh, maybe we're hitting the 20s now. Like, this is going to be our roaring 20s. We're going to emerge from World War I, emerge from the plague, and we're just going to hit the ground running and just fucking do the Charleston and get drunk for 10 years.
As soon as you said maybe this is the 20s, I just was like, I readied myself for the hit. And I was like, yeah, but right after.
I didn't know about Delta. No one fucking told me about that shit. No one told me about Delta and critical race theory.
Anyway, about the book.
About the book. So I was like, I'm going to do some optimistic books. I'm going to do some books that are about, I mean, they're going to have sadness and suffering because that's what narrative is.
Drama.
But they're going to be more along the lines of Up in the Sky, like we just talked about, which is a book about, which is the most simple of all Superman books. A girl gets kidnapped and he rescues her. Spoilers. So I was like, I want to do that again, but with Supergirl, where just like the theme of the book is not like all that stuff we're talking about, Rorschach, about all these deep stuff. So like the theme of this book is Supergirl is awesome and she saves the day. And she's just, and they're like, yeah, do that. And I pitched, you know, I was looking around for a plot, and usually when I'm looking for plots, I steal from old movies. I've probably heard that enough. So I stole this one from an old movie that had been remade into a much better movie, which is True Grit. And my wife and I had watched that, and I'd read the book. It's one of my favorite books of all time. And I was like,
just want to say, I picked that up. Yeah. Oh, this is True Grit, which is not a problem.
Not subtle as a comparison. And I was like, okay, well, this is perfect because that's about a young woman, you know, and this will be about, and I just need like, I just need a craggy old guy, I'll just Lobo or somebody like that. And so young woman, craggy old guy, and I'll just do True Grit in space. And I'll adjust it along the way so it's not exactly True Grit. And I pitched that to Jamie, and he was the one who had the insight of like, well, what if we make Supergirl the craggy old person, make her the John Wayne character, and then have another sort of, instead of her being the naive, she's the person who's been through something. And I talked to Steve Orlando about Supergirl, and he had the observation, which is the most obvious observation, not to insult Steve, but I had not thought of it. But when he threw it in front of me, I was like, oh, he's like, the thing about Supergirl is like she had lived on Krypton until she was 14 and then blasted off into Argo City. And then Argo City got destroyed And then she got sick. Like Superboy doesn't fucking remember any of that. He's just a boy who woke up in an ideal place, and kind of people told me he had sad memories. Supergirl was like witnessed the Holocaust by the time she was a kid. And you know me, I'm like, oh, sweet trauma. Awesome, you know? And so then I was like, oh, so yeah. So then her is sort of the rugged, cynical veteran who kicks ass and bonds with a young girl and sort of goes through this sort of space adventure that became Supergirl. And then, of course, we didn't have an artist, and he said Bilquis would do it, and I immediately jumped in the air and realized I had something special. I didn't honestly realize how special, because that book is, Bilquis drives that book.
Oh,
and Matias Lopez, the artist, just, she's doing this. It's not, Bilquis is funny because, like, her art is not out of the mainstream. Like, it's not like she's like the anti-Jim Lee. But it's got this European tinge to it where it's, I don't know, it's like if someone took Jim but raised him in France. It's like, it's and Matias Lopez on colors, the two of them work together so well. And
you're not at a loss for working with great artists. And it is a trait of my favorite comic book writers that they know enough to make sure that they're working with people who are great. And that's another one of the, it's just one of those things I'm always impressed. I'm like, oh, you got a good person, because you can write great stuff, but you need a person who can make it sing. And not just, there are lots of great comic book artists for different things, but this has that European space opera thing, you know, like there's like this,
yeah.
It's like everything's getting hit with a little bit of wind.
You know, yeah, that's right.
It's just got a little something, and it's like the perfect amount of silly and melodrama, but then also, gravitas, I guess, for lack of a better word. I can't think of it, but you know, it's all those things mixed together, and it kind of just, it hums, and it's not too much. Like the book's not too much. I don't have a lot of deep, like, where's the symbolism? Like, it doesn't matter. Like, they go out there, she's real badass. You know, and it's fun to watch. You know, that's kind of, one time, a long time ago, I was at some panel. This would have been 2001, 2, whatever. And I think it was a DC Writers panel. And Judd Winnick, who was, I think, I forget what it was, but somebody in the audience, because this is comics, complained that Hawk Girl was on the Justice League at the time. I was like, well, why is it going to be her? And Judd's just like, it's a girl with wings and a mace. She hits people with her mace and her wings. Why wouldn't you do that? And I think you've got an element of this in that, which is, you know, she's as strong as Superman and she has more issues than him, but she's younger. And that's really interesting. I don't feel like that's been touched enough.
Yeah, I like it. I think the reason maybe it doesn't feel as much like me is because I had not used captions since Vision. So that's like 6 years of me not using captions. And so to return to that, and of course it's very much stolen from Portis's, you know, it's this like kind of space cowboy tone, but
whatever.
So, and it's super, but it was super fun. And it was, you know, I get to use all sorts of, you know, words I don't usually, like I was doing something today, I was like, oh, hither and thither I used in this thing. I was like, good job, Tom. It's not a normal word I would normally use in a script. You can always tell I'm a terrible speller. So when I spell check my, you know, I have autocorrect on this, so my computer's learned what a bad speller is and usually just fixes everything. But when, like, at the end of when I'm my spell check is going crazy and fixing a lot of words, I was like, oh, good, I use new words in this.
Nice work.
So yeah, that's my pride. Yeah. So I love Supergirl. Human Target is very much a companion book to Supergirl in terms of it being a straight line episodic story with captions that touches on dark topics, but is not meant to be dark like Rorschach and Strange Adventures are.
Well, I'm excited to see how all of the trauma from this last year and a half comes out in forms of superheroes that you've turned into people that fans are not going to like. I think that's, the way to go.
I'm writing a thing now. It hasn't been announced, but it's the most obscure superheroes you've ever heard of. these are more obscure than obscure. Like, we have no idea how to sell this. We couldn't even come up with the title because none of the superheroes are famous enough that their name would work as a title. So we were just struggling and struggling. We went through four names before we settled on something, which I still am not sure I love. But yeah, so you'll see that 2 years from now or whatever.
How do you get along thinking I need to sell books and I have no idea how to pick things that people want, but it still seems to be working for me? That must keep you up at night.
It does. It keeps me up at night.
Here's my idea. People seem to be buying it. I don't know why. I'm just going to do this again.
I just bought a page of this guy. I can't remember his name, but there was an old, not old, but when I was a kid, there was a Suicide Squad member. And his thing was, he was obsessed with this god who he thought was going to come and blow up the world. And as part of his religion, every time he killed someone, the god was pushed back 1,000 years. So in
who
Suicide
wrote
Squad, that's John Outstrander.
Jesus.
Right.
Wow.
And I think the god's name was like Khalid or something. I'm sure it was not entirely politically correct for the 80s, but it was a cool concept. And so when I was, you know, he would kill someone, he'd choke them. He was kind of like a ninja kind of guy. He would like cut their head off or something. And he'd go, another 1,000 years, Khalid, you know, like. And I think of that every time I like write up a stupid pitch and they like, okay, Tom, you're greenlit. I was like, all right, another 2 months, Khalid. I have pushed unemployment back.
That's brilliant. I'm a big fan of everything that just happened. All right, I'm calling it.
All right. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you. This was an admirer
of yours. I follow you. I know it seems weird because I don't know, we're friends from afar. We haven't even had dinner, I think, once. But I followed you on Instagram and Twitter for 15 years now, which is so like my wife follows you on Instagram. Like I was like, oh, I'm having a plan. He's like, oh, well, ask how his wife is doing. Say hi for me.
I noticed that at one point. I was like, I think that's Tom's wife. I was like, okay, cool. But yeah, there's been no dinners or anything. We should do that in person and then not record it. It'll be amazing.
Yes, anytime. Let me take you out to some fancy dinner.
All right, you got it.
Spend some Rorschach money I stole on you.
Woo! All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
And that's another episode of Talksplode in the books. I want to thank Tom for spending all that time. I think we had a good time, though. I don't think it felt like it was too long. That's what I think. Do you think he likes me? You can go to ifanboy.com. You can find our other Talksplodes and all the podcasts we've done. You can find Tom on social media at those things. I think he's on the Facebook and the Instagram and the Twitter. I bet without too much effort you could find it there. I want to thank the iFanboy patrons for supporting the show and bringing back these interview shows and the media explodes and the book explodes and all those good things. And that is all. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.